Up to the university.
How am I?
So Fitz, welcome to the committee.
Maybe don't look so good.
And we're going to get right into this. Because you all know why we're here, because we're looking at what you're going to do to hopefully save our higher education, public higher education system. And in the next biennium, when we're looking at terrible, terrible cuts that could be looming unless something happens and we got to change our heart or a new governor. And we'll have that either way. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have a little slideshow I'm going to walk you through. So why don't we just dive right into it. If you turn to the second page, there's a bar chart there. And just to ground everybody in what I'm going to be talking about today. As you may recall, we started this biennium with the University of Minnesota, started this biennium with a, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, 1 minute. Started this biennium with a base budget of $702.6 million. And at the end of last session, the 2009 session, the university's budget was cut down to $623.4 million. And you also then appropriated in the second year of the biennium $677.3 million. But as you know, the governor subsequently unallotted that figure by $50 million and took the university's budget down to $627.3 million. Then the 2010 legislature, as a result of the conference committee action that was just signed by the governor, took the university's budget down to the 2006 level of $591.1 million. The original 2009 session law, Article 1, Section 5, Subdivision 2B, asked the Board of Regents to submit an expenditure reduction plan by March 15th of 2010 to achieve the 2012 and 2013 base. And I believe, I'll stand corrected, but I believe that may be included in your packet of materials there. The university did submit that plan. And I want to talk about how we're arriving at that 2012 and 13 base. But arriving at that base was and is a little problematic for both Minsky and the University of Minnesota, because if you turn to the next page, the actual legislation that was adopted last session, the 2009 session, set the university's base for 12 and 13. The original law set it at $670 million, which was in fact higher than the appropriation that we'll have for fiscal 11 at the conclusion of this legislative session, that $591 million figure. In fact, it was higher than the number, the actual appropriation you put into the 2009 session law. And as we prepared our response to the 12 and 13 budget reduction plan, how to arrive at that base, we made a decision that it wouldn't be appropriate to set our budget in fiscal 10 or 11 to land at that $670 million number. And in fact, given the economic outlook for the state and the fact that there is quite a budget shortfall unless economic conditions improve enormously in the next biennium, that it was more prudent for us to think about a different number. And as we approach thinking about that number, we had one number we knew about that was the base for 12. Well, we had two numbers. We had the $670 million that was in law from last session. We had the governor's recommendation that, in fact, was $583.9 million base. And now the other number we have since we submitted this report is the conference committee report set a new fiscal 12 and 13 base of what we believe is $647.5 million. Now, we're grateful that that base for 12 and 13 is the starting point for budget discussions next biennium, but it's not, in our judgment, a realistic place for us to build a budget on for the current biennium. So we have chosen to respond to the legislative request by how we're going to arrive at a recurring base of $591.1 million, substantially below what you established last year in law and substantially below what you put in law this fiscal year. If by some miracle, and we're hopeful that the legislature actually appropriated a recurring $647 million next biennium, that suddenly the state budget situation improves, I think that's wishful thinking, but miracles happen, that we would actually be able to begin to reinvest, because our recurring based budget for the university will be set at the end of fiscal 11 at the $591 million level. Now, I'm going to take you through some slides to tell you how we're getting there, what we're doing to get there. If you turn to slide 4, and I'll just stop here a minute, I'm battling a cold. When the university approaches its budget situation on an annual basis, it's always made up of two parts. It's what the state has done to us, which recently has been reductions, and what our cost increases are beyond what, again, the state's done to us. And in fiscal 10, the fiscal year we're in today, the university a year ago, when the session was done, faced about $136 million budget challenge. That was made up of the reduction from our $702 million base that we had coming into this biennium, recurring base, and about a $57 million increase in operating costs. And I'll come back to talk about how we addressed the current year budget in a minute. But going forward, looking into fiscal 11, which is where we're planning right now to land at that $591 million figure, we face right now an estimated $132 million budget challenge, which is made up of the fact that the conference committee reduced us from our fiscal 10 funding level by $32.3 million, and we face about $100 million of additional costs. So I'm going to talk about how we're addressing that $132 million first. And in addressing that $132 million, the university's budget will be established at that $591 million recurring funding level that'll take us to whatever the next, whatever happens in 12 and 13. In page 5, again, for fiscal 11, it starts July 1. About 25% of the budget challenge that we face next year is because of the budget reduction that the legislature and the governor recommended and is now enacted into law. And about 75% of the challenge is cost increases that the university faces. Those are made up of a couple of things. Perhaps you've heard about it on the radio or seen it in the paper. We're on biweekly payroll at the University of Minnesota. And just coincidental with everything else that's going on, we face a $41 million additional compensation cost in fiscal 11 because of that extra pay period. So that happened to hit at exactly the wrong time for us, but it is a part of the budget challenge that we're dealing with for next year. We also have other expenditure needs that I'll highlight in a moment. In addressing that $132 million budget challenge, about 35% of that challenge will be met with tuition revenue. We testified here last year that tuition revenue on average would go up about 7.5%. Now recall that in the legislation that you adopted last year, that for Minnesota resident undergraduates, as we did in the current fiscal year, we will also do that next fiscal year, we will be buying that increase down for Minnesota resident undergraduates to $450, which is roughly a 4.5% tuition increase. In the current fiscal year, academic year, we brought that down to $300, which was about a 3.1% increase. That's required by your appropriation bill that was enacted last year. And we will use stimulus dollars to buy that tuition down. If you turn to page 6, setting aside that part of our challenge that's created by the budget cut from the legislature and the governor, we face about $100 million of additional costs. Roughly 73% of that is compensation related. It's the extra pay period of $41 million and a plan on our part to provide a 2% compensation pool to our employees for fiscal 11. In fiscal 10, in addressing our budget shortfall, we froze wages in the current fiscal year. And the president did not feel that it would be appropriate to freeze wages 2 years in a row. So in the second year of the biennium, the big part of our additional costs is compensation related. We also have increases in financial aid and scholarship costs, our Founders Program, our Middle Income Scholarship Program. We have facility cost increases, and we're going to face increases in technology licensing fees and software costs, and a hope to make some minor academic investments in some new programs. Page 7, how do we address the budget shortfall? After we increase tuition, that solves about 35% of the problem in fiscal 11. We have about an $85 million remaining problem for the university to address. And we're addressing that problem. You've probably heard about this on the radio, and the faculty did in fact vote 130-26 to take a pay reduction, a one-time pay reduction. That's the 22% of the problem. Being solved through 3 days of furlough for our civil service and bargaining unit employees and a 1.15% pay cut for faculty and staff, with the higher paid, as we call them, the lucky 85 at the university, taking a 2.3% pay reduction. We will also delay for faculty, not civil service and bargaining unit, but faculty, the 2% compensation pool increase to January of next year, which will save about 11% of this problem will be addressed that way. And then units will have to find one-time money to cover the remaining part of that $41 million 27th paycheck. The remaining part of our budget problem, about $34 million after we've taken those actions, will be done with 2.75% budget reductions on academic and support units. That's on top of a 5.5% budget reductions that academic and support units system-wide took at the university in the current fiscal year in addressing the challenge we had this year. I want to shift back because right now, in addressing the fiscal 11 budget reductions, we're currently in that time of the season at the university where we are meeting with support units and academic units and going through making the decisions about what will be cut and reduced at the university for fiscal 11. But we're finished making the decisions. We made them this time last year for fiscal 10, and I want to give you some highlights because it'll be very similar actions taken next year. And of course, we are a people business, and about in arriving at what is $95 million worth of cuts, about 5.5% on average inside the university, it's primarily coming out of eliminating faculty positions, staff positions, and in some cases student positions, TAs, RAs, and the like. We've identified about, for the current fiscal year, about 1,200 positions out of roughly 17,000 positions at the university that will be eliminated as a result of the budget actions taken for fiscal 10. We jumped on this issue early by launching an early retirement incentive program a little over a year ago, anticipating that there were going to be budget cuts. And that was a very successful program for us and allowed us to get a jump on reducing staff. As everyone knows, it's very difficult and challenging to reduce staff in a very planned and thoughtful way. And it was just fortuitous for us that we had a very successful early retirement incentive program. positions were reduced in almost every academic and support unit, and it really did amount to about 90% of what we saved. If you turn to page 9, I just want to highlight some examples for you of what the actions we've had to take. In the area, for example, of facilities management. And again, these are just examples that we had to take to meet the challenge of fiscal 10. As I said, we're dealing now with the challenge of fiscal 11. We've reduced private office cleaning from 5 days per week to one, and lab cleaning from 3 days a week to one. I have to now actually take my own garbage to a main receptacle. They don't come around and take it for me anymore. We've had, in undergraduate education, we've restructured classroom technical services. In the libraries, we've had to reconfigure and reduce the number of service points. Wilson Library used to have 13 service points for folks to come and get help. They're down to 7. In the Office of Information Technology, we're fortunate, again, here on timing, I guess, although I've been beat up pretty bad about the fact that we replaced our financial system just 2 years ago. In replacing that system, we moved from one that was a mainframe base to a server base, and we were actually able to eliminate the software maintenance and the old positions that used to support the mainframe software system. And it was a lucky break on our part, but we saved significant costs in that implementing the new system. They also implemented a hiring freeze in information technology that eliminated about 34 positions. In the academic area on page 10, the Carlson School of Management, they had to restructure the delivery of instruction. They increased section sizes, altered TA allocations, reduced sections, reduced printing and consultants. Liberal arts eliminated 52 faculty positions. Most of those faculty positions, of course, were open positions, many of them generated through the early retirement incentive program, or positions that became vacant that the dean was going to redeploy, and as a result of the budget cuts, we weren't able to place those vacant positions, and they were cut from the budget. CLA had to eliminate 22 staff positions. We eliminated a fiscal service team in CLA. Institute of Technology eliminated 17 faculty positions, over 20 staff positions, reduced $1.4 million from TA budgets, cut $1 million from instructional equipment and computing. Similar stories at Duluth and some of the other schools on the Twin Cities campus in Crookston and Morris. Those are just highlights and examples of things and actions that were taken in the current fiscal year to meet the challenge today. As I said, we're working on the challenge for fiscal 11, and we should have those decisions finalized and presented to the Board of Regents at its June board meeting. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I would like to just highlight some good news in all of this, and that's on slide 11. And then I'll wrap up and we'll see what questions you have. There is some good news in all of this. The university, in sponsored grant contracts, has been awarded 279 awards totaling $141 million from the Economic Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the stimulus bill. Our faculty, despite the challenges that we face in the budget, we're tracking these, we have to report these, and we've been very successful. We've gotten about 82% of the dollars we've asked for. These are grants that have been awarded as a result of that stimulus legislation that was passed at the federal level. As you know, we also received state fiscal stabilization money, $89.3 million in last year's appropriation bill. And that money has been extremely important to us. We would have liked more, but it's been very important to us as we reduce our operations. We have used those dollars strategically to help do it. On slide 12, just to remind you, we received $601,000 from what was called the Government Services Fund. I don't know why, but we got it. We took it. And then $88.7 million from the Education Stabilization Fund. Our goal with that money was to save jobs, mitigate tuition impacts. We are reporting the information and jobs saved to the state of Minnesota. The state of Minnesota is actually the recipient, so we give the information to them, and they report it to the federal government. And we've used these dollars carefully to invest them in a one-time basis, knowing that we have a cliff that we all face in fiscal 12 and 13. On page 13, just to highlight again, of the $89.3 million, we used about 52% of that to mitigate tuition impacts. That's directly a result of the agreement and the legislation that you folks passed last year that brought down tuition for Minnesota resident undergraduate students. We also used just under half of that money as a what we call the stimulus bridge pool to meet and help units bridge to those cuts. And on page 14, of that $43.1 million, $28.4 million has been allocated in the current fiscal year to units. For example, in facilities management on the Twin Cities campus, they had to reduce about 35 custodial positions as a result of the budget cuts. We used stimulus dollars to keep those folks employed during this two-year period with the hope that the normal attrition in the ranks of the custodial employees at the University of Minnesota will allow those folks that otherwise, without the stimulus money, would have been laid off immediately to find a way back into permanent employment as the attrition occurs. Now, the attrition, of course, isn't happening quite at the pace that it normally would in a job-friendly economy, but it's still been instrumental and helpful for us to keep employees around. But those employees have been told that at the end of the biennium, on June 30th of 11, those employees will be gone because we did not have money in fiscal 12 to retain those positions. We did not, however, allocate all of that $43.1 million in the current fiscal year because, again, we felt it was highly likely that we would face budget cuts again in fiscal 11. So we reserved $14.7 million, which we will redeploy now, allocate to units, again, for purposes of bridging folks to those lower employment levels, but trying to keep people around. For example, TAs or RAs use those dollars to help in the instructional load and bridge them to the next biennium. So we'll use these dollars strategically, again, just like we've used the $28.4 million. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that sums up just our approach, and I hope it gives you a sense of the plan and the efforts we're taking to land at $591.1 million in our recurring budget for at the end of fiscal 11.
Okay. Before we get to questions, Representative Carlson, would you please quit harassing members of the audience? Even if they're related to you.
Well, it
has
to be my
wife. Yes, I know. Can I wave to her, too? I saw you waving. Okay, questions at all? Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, this is a really big picture overview, but when you talk about the cuts to the number of faculty, I think one of the things our committee has had concern about and tried to keep track of is how staff cuts affect not only the number of sections or the class size, but what courses are offered and how this affects the graduation timeline for students and what the how those consequences roll out in terms of their impact on the student. Could you comment on that and how you're tracking that and trying to mitigate those losses?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're not seeing at this point dramatic increases in section sizes. So we're still fairly confident that it's not going to have a significant, I'm not going to say it's not going to have an effect on students, but we are watching that carefully. In this year's budget discussions with the deans of the colleges, we're in fact dialoguing with them about that. And I think some of this stimulus money that we didn't allocate last year, that remaining $14.7 million, will provide some help to some of the colleges that may be feeling more stress about that. But we're acutely aware of it and watching it.
Mr. Fitzenritter, you said tuition is going to make up 35% of your solution. What is What percentage of the of your budget income or your income is tuition? Is it pretty much similar?
Well, if you look at the it's over of the O&M, which is your state appropriation, state specials, and tuition. Tuition's more than half of it, of that 1.5 billion, almost 1.6 billion.
But that's not my question. Is your if you bring in 2 billion a year or whatever, I can't remember what your numbers were.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're a $3 billion a year operation.
$3 billion. And how much of that is, what percentage of that is tuition?
Probably about a third. That it's a little distorting because in that $3 billion is 500 plus million of sponsored research, which isn't fungible to use on something that would replace tuition, nor is the parking money or the housing money or the auxiliary activities.
And then in the there's as you see in here, and we're all seeing what the repercussions are from lack of funding for our public higher education system, but the layoffs with the staff again, is it seems to be instructor heavy, which of course it would be because that's the nature of your business, but are the layoffs, or I shouldn't say layoffs, the early retirements and potential layoffs pretty much mirror the overall different employee groups at the university?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have about 3,000 faculty, and the remaining 14,000-15,000 employees are civil service bargaining unit and professional academic employees. It's naturally going to fall more heavily and is falling more heavily on the civil service bargaining unit, professional academic, than faculty. We all know about tenure. That's where the early retirement and incentive programs come in for faculty, but the bulk of the employees are going to be reduced necessarily in civil service bargaining unit and academic administrative.
And have, for lack of a better word, your administrative personnel been offered the early retirements and taken them and had the layoffs equal with the
yes.
faculty and other staff. Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzenritter, can you tell me, of the reductions that you made, what percent has been in instructional, what percent of the reductions were instructional spending reductions, and what percent was administrative reductions?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we actually don't make the decisions by what I'd call, as I testified when we did a show and tell here last year, on it would only be after the budget is closed that I could give you a sense of how much was instruction versus non-instruction, because we don't budget that way when we make the decisions. I can tell you after the fact,
Mr.
when
Chair.
I see the results of the actual spending.
Can you do that for 2010 then? Okay, great, thank you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions. The sponsored grants from the stimulus money, $141 million, you didn't lay out, you laid out on the $89 million of the fiscal stabilization funds, kind of how that was laid out over the fiscal years. Are those sponsored grants and contracts kind of similarly applied to the 2 years of our current biennial years, or do those last longer? How's that $141 million distributed?
Mr. Chairman, members, those are based on grant proposals submitted to the federal government under the umbrella of the opportunities in the stimulus bill at the federal level, and they're often multi-year awards. They'll go 2-3 years. We can, I didn't spend time today highlighting examples, but I could certainly provide you with, there's you can see how many there are. Each one of them is uniquely identified and named and described, so we could provide you a list of what they're for, what areas, what part of research, what they're doing.
Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, thank you. That'd be helpful. You're just looking at it in the aggregate, then, if you looked at the ARRA money that the university has been able to take advantage of, it's $230 million. And if all of that were kind of deployed in flexible ways that you so chose in the two fiscal years that we're dealing with in our biennium here, you'd almost have kind of bridged the overall deficit gap. But it sounds like maybe these things are over multiple years and they're targeted at things that aren't your normal lines of expenditure. Is that a fair characterization?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes.
Yeah, Representative Downey, the money that we got through the state for higher education, we kind of determined how we would use it, and we reached an agreement with the university, or tried to tell them, that so much would be used for tuition and for reducing fixed costs, etc. But I believe most of the $141 million is probably for research grants.
Mr. Chairman, that's
or
right.
All of it, because yeah. I noticed that your, you know, the president in his State of the University talked about the grants now, or excuse me, research grants being about $700 million. If I recall, typically you were at $600 or a little less. And so, Representative Downey, you bring up a good point, but I don't think that money
right.
can be used to do things like we had hoped to use our money to help out when the reductions come in the following biennium. My question to you, related to his, though, before I get to you, Representative Carlson, is so has the research, the different research professors and their staffs been actually increased because of this, or have they also looked at decreases, or are those decreases with professors, et cetera, happening in more in the classroom type setting than in the research setting because of these extra grants you're getting?
You know, Mr. Chairman, members, I'll have to do a little research on that for you. I would say that the research faculty have not been as impacted. It's more on, which would go to your point, more on the instructional side.
Which worries me, but also I realize the importance of the research. Representative, a follow-up on that?
If I could, Mr. Chairman, just actually a separate question. On the 1,200 positions...
Well, wait, no, related, but a separate. Go ahead. That sounds like a Republican answer. Go ahead on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the 1,200 positions that were unfunded, it indicates that some were open positions, some were early retirement and layoffs. How many of those were actual layoffs as compared to maybe open positions that hadn't ever been staffed versus open positions that, you know, just weren't hired to fill, et cetera? Was there a large percentage that were actual layoffs?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'd put that number at 300 to 350 of layoffs, people that received notice. The early retirement incentive program really helped us get in front of being able to avoid significant numbers of layoffs.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I had a follow-up to your earlier question. Mr. Fitzenreiter, you said tuition covered about one-third of the $3 billion. The way I would frame that question is in terms of cost of instruction. How much is tuition covering of the cost of instruction? The benchmark, you know, years ago used to be one-third, and I know the university was way above that in current years, so, or in recent years. So what is the relationship with tuition and the cost of instruction?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I know it's been years since the university did an instructional cost study to come up with that number, but I'll phone a friend and see if Peter Zetterberg... Sounds like 70% from my colleague.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, when we talk about what's happening on the instructional side, then that gives you a really good benchmark in terms of when most of us at this table attended a college or university. I remember at one time when I was chairing this committee years ago, the university was 30-some percent. State universities were roughly 20% of the cost of instruction. Then it went to one-third. And now we've just heard that students are paying 70% of the cost of instruction. So today's generation of students are paying much more, double literally, what most of us at this table would have paid years ago.
And that's why they're all in debt, many of them, for a lifetime.
That's correct.
Any other questions then? Representative Robert Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I came in a bit late, so if you addressed this already, I apologize. But the 1,200 positions were unfunded or eliminated because of the no new funds coming in. And I know some of that was backfilled with the ARRA money. Are you anticipating that in 12 and 13, if there's no new funding that comes to the university, we'll see similarly about 1,200 positions eliminated? And do you anticipate that the retirement incentives that I assume will be ongoing then will still take up 2/3 of that those losses?
Fitz. You know, we're beginning to think about and are beginning to model some scenarios about 12 and 13. How much, you know, as I said earlier, we'd love to see that $647 million target you set in your bill this year. But we're starting to think about how much are we going to go below 591 and beginning to model what might happen to tuition and what might happen to further budget cuts. And then we'll also face cost increases. So we're starting to model that. With respect to an early retirement incentive program, those programs work well if you offer them every couple of years. We can actually look and see, well, how many employees are likely to take an early retirement incentive program, because you're really trying to bridge them to their age 65. So how many employees do we have at 62 that we could attract them to go 3 years early by giving them 3 years of health care, which is what this program was about. Right now, if we offered another early retirement incentive program, we wouldn't capture very many people, because this last one captured sort of that bubble that was there to get. So it may not be a very attractive program for us to, we'll probably look at it again in 12 and 13, but it really depends on how many people we've got in that window that we could try to convince to go.
Mr. Chair, then I guess my response to that, or my thoughts about that, are that if there are going to be positions eliminated, it sounds like they're going to come out of the true layoff piece, unless we figure out a more balanced approach to going forward with the funding here.
Any further questions then? Yes. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzenreiter, let's say if we had that miracle that you mentioned, and say we were at that beginning base that we talked about, it was $702 million, what would be the first thing that the university would do? Would they lower the tuition costs for students, or would we be looking at doing the rehiring of faculty?
You know, I actually, driving over here today, thought somebody might ask that question. It's hard for me to speak for the Board of Regents on that, or what the next president of the university, because next year we'll have a new president, would do. But if there was an opportunity to invest again, that we had new money, clearly there's that issue of the stimulus money disappearing for our employees, and we'd like to try to keep some of those. There's the issue of increasing need that we're seeing for financial aid, so that'd be a place. And then we'd begin to do, I believe, some targeted reinvestments and rehiring of faculty. So it'd probably be those three things: financial aid, try to get some of our workers back that we otherwise are going to have to see go when the stimulus money goes out, and begin to reinvest in faculty lines.
Thank you.
Done, Representative Detmer.
That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to talk about the research side of the university and just ask a question that's similar to Representative Carlson's, but would you have an idea how much do federal and private grants pay for research?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
I don't have that number off the top of my head. Your question is how much...
In addition, like the tuition pays for the cost of instruction, how much would the grants that the researchers are capturing, hopefully federal and private grants, how much that is actually covering their costs of doing the research?
Well, this is a tricky question, and here's why. when a researcher applies to the federal, to NIH for a research grant, that application goes in and they'll ask for $100,000, and that'll cover all of the direct costs of that research. All right? The federal government will award a grant and cover all of the 100% of the direct costs of that research. What they won't fully cover is the indirect costs. And the university has to negotiate an indirect cost recovery rate with the federal government. Some parts of the federal government don't pay any. Some pay, NIH or NSF pays, I think our rate is about 52%. So on a $100,000 direct cost, we'll get another 52. But we can actually demonstrate our indirect costs at the 65 or 68% rate. So the federal government isn't paying they'll pay the direct cost, they're not paying the indirect, and the university, frankly, subsidizes that indirect cost. They will not fully pay us for the indirect aspects. And that indirect aspect of the research is the equipment that gets used in the lab, the cost of the electricity, the space, the administration of the grant, et cetera. They will not fully cover those costs.
Mr. Chair? Just as a follow-up then, is there a kind of a breaking point for the cost of a grant application that you'd look at as far as trying to recapture those indirect costs?
That's a question that would be worth talking to our Vice President for Research, Tim Mulcahy. Mm-hmm. We know that we have an indirect cost recovery rate of 50-some percent, but our effective rate that we actually recover is below 30%, because in some cases either the granting agency won't pay it or will waive it because we want the grant, the direct grant activity. We're looking at and have a group working on trying to increase our indirect cost recovery as a revenue strategy mm-hmm. to help meet our budget obligations, because we can recover more than our effective rate of slightly under 30%, that's money to the bottom line to help academic units and the university meet its costs.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But we haven't turned a grant down over that issue yet.
Okay, further questions? Mr. Fitzmiller, thank you then.
Thanks.
The picture isn't that bright, members. Representative Detmer, I can perform miracles too, so just keep that in mind, you know, this fall. next, we have the Chancellor coming up. Chancellor, I don't know. Welcome, Chancellor McCormick, and you want to just give us a brief introduction, and then we're going to get to some of your presidents.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm really honored to be with the committee along with the presidents of our colleges and universities today. These individuals are the faces of our leadership for the Minnesota State College and University System. These are the women and men who have joined me to tackle the very difficult decisions presented to the system over the past several years, but especially this year, as we have witnessed the state appropriation drop. And I want you to know, I want them to stand, I'm proud of all of them.
My colleagues, the presidents, please stand.
At all these universities and colleges, the presidents have been involved in the planning and consultation with faculty, staff, and students about how to balance their budgets while continuing to meet the vision of providing the most accessible, highest value education in the nation to enable the people of Minnesota to succeed. I commend you for focusing today's discussion on the future of higher education. It is a topic that is on the minds of higher education leaders across the country. We are all seeking to develop a sound, long-term strategy, one that will align revenues and expenditures with our mission while assuring for our students and the citizens of Minnesota educational quality. It is the judgment of these national leaders that public higher education in America is at a crossroads. The public, as you know so very well from talking to your constituents, are demanding better results for more students. Minnesota has reaped large rewards from its historic investment in higher education, access, attainment, completion. It's been part of our core values for a long time. We know that the future of our state depends upon it. I will be listening to the testimony, and Mr. Chairman will be available for the rest of the time to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chancellor. And first, we're going to bring up Ann Winia. Where did I see Ann? Welcome, our former colleague and majority leader. And Ann, I wanted you to come today because, you know, you're retiring, and so you can say whatever the hell you want today. Tell us the truth.
Okay, okay.
And I've always, you know, liked that in you, so go ahead. Okay. Take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of this committee. And actually, because you gave me a little notice about the fact that I was going to be called on to testify, I've given a little bit of thought about what I want to say. And I realize the first thing I want to say is thank you to all of you for serving. Having sat in those chairs, I know that you are serving in the midst of incredibly difficult times. And there have got to be days when you come to work and you think, this really isn't a lot of fun. You were all just off for a little break. I hope you had some of your constituents who came up and told you they think you're doing a heck of a job. Because I realize that in the kind of financial situation that Minnesota is in, it is going to take very dedicated service to figure the way out of this. And I appreciate that you're all willing to put yourself in that particular spot. I've had the great benefit of getting to dabble a little bit in all three aspects of higher education in Minnesota. Most of my career has been with the community college system, but I had the wonderful opportunity to also serve as a regent of the University of Minnesota, and I've even taught at a couple of private colleges. And as I think about higher education in Minnesota, one of the things that impresses me most is the strength of a system of higher education that encompasses all of those providers and how important it is that we all work together to ensure that the people of Minnesota appreciate, value, and support higher education. I've also had the chance to work in health and human services. Let me tell you, higher education is a much happier place to be because in higher education, you're actually changing lives. You get the opportunity to take a person who's been laid off of a job and they're desperate to figure out how they're going to be able to continue to support their family, and you get a chance to work with them and provide them with some new skills and training so they can actually go out and get a job, maybe even a better job. And we serve many of the new Americans who are moving to Minnesota, and they bring those same aspirations. They want a better life for themselves and their kids, and they know that higher education is the critical piece that they must obtain to get there. I think of higher education as the positive solution to so many of Minnesota's problems. Because to the extent that we have a workforce that is educated, that is skilled, and that is sought after by employers, we have the opportunity to benefit this economy and get Minnesota growing again. I'd share with you now that we currently at the community colleges, and I speak collectively for my colleagues at the two-year community and technical colleges, we are experiencing the highest explosion in demand for our services than Minnesota has ever experienced. At my particular campus, our enrollments were only up 10% this year. I have colleagues where the enrollment growth has been 15, 16, 18%. For us, that has meant that as we have worked to figure out how we're going to serve an additional 1,000 students, because that's how many more folks showed up this year than last year, we have done it with minimal hiring because the funds, the resources simply are not available. The one category in which we have actually hired additional personnel is we have hired, if you look at our FTE equivalents in the faculty ranks, we have 10 more faculty than we had a year ago. But if you look at all the other ranks throughout our employees at the community college, at North Hennepin Community College, you'll see that we're stable. And so we've simply said, we've got to be more efficient. We've got to be more productive. We've got to ensure that we can serve these people, but we're going to have to do it with the resources that we have. I did relent the other day, and I agreed that we would allow our financial aid office to hire one more financial aid advisor. That's because the number of applicants for financial aid, since we last added anybody several years ago, has gone up 3,000 applications a year. It's a lot of people, a lot of families to work with, because when we're talking about people's money, there's a lot of questions that have to be answered. But those are the kind of pressures that we are putting on every employee at the college. And so as I look ahead to the future and think about, so what are our options available to us? I would share with you that I look at the options as being, one, a serious conversation about, do we have to limit our enrollment? Because if we can't add faculty, when students show up and there's a demand for another math class or another biology class, if you can't add faculty, then you turn them away and you in effect say to them, this time college is not one of your options. But that to me is the hardest choice to make, and I would argue that it is the one that is most damaging to Minnesota's well-being off into the future. We've already begun conversations with our faculty about the possibility of increasing class size. And I would share with you that faculty work very hard. They are first and always teachers, and they teach 15 credits a semester. And if you'll indulge me, I just have to share a story with you, because I want to talk about both a student and a teacher at our college, and I'm enormously proud of both of them, and they to me represent the real value that is to be found in Minnesota's community colleges and system of higher education. I'm sharing with you a picture that was, a year ago, it was the cover of our college magazine. You'll see on this cover, you'll see a woman who was selected last year by the Carnegie Foundation as the outstanding college professor in America. We're enormously proud of her at North Hennepin Community College. She is the only Minnesotan to ever receive that award. But the person I want to tell you about the most is the young man who's standing next to her, Taj Melson. Taj started out at a state university, and he was interested in playing hockey. And he played probably pretty good hockey, but he didn't do very good on his schoolwork. And as is unfortunately sometimes the case, he flunked out and decided to pursue a career in professional hockey. Well, he did that for a number of years, and then I think probably after a particularly painful game, he must have realized that his body wasn't going to enjoy that at age 40. And so he wanted to get back into school, but because his grades had been so bad, the only place he could come was an open access community college where we'll give you another chance and take you back. So Taj came to North Hennepin, and I've subsequently had some conversations with Taj, and here's what I will share with you. He was initially enormously embarrassed to be at a community college. Probably because, you know, his old buddies back at the State U or whatever wouldn't have thought too highly of that. But Taj found that his life was turned around when he took a chemistry class from Dr. Eugenius Paulus. And he quickly became an outspoken fan of the community colleges. And when he graduated from North Hennepin, I got a letter from him in which he explained all this. And he talked about the fabulous teachers that he had had at the community college. Now, I will share with you that Taj went on, and he's now graduated from the University of Michigan Medical School. And he's doing a residency in emergency room medicine at North Memorial Hospital, right there in North Hennepin Community College's own backyard. So when I look at this picture, I'm as proud as I can be of Eugenia, because she represents the kind of dedication of the teachers that we have. But I also think about our mission, our open access mission, to give people a chance who might have screwed up someplace along the way to demonstrate just what they can do. And that's the kind of the thought that makes me very sad at the prospects that we might actually have to reduce our open admissions and turn people away who want to make life-changing decisions. Currently, those students at North Hennepin are paying roughly two-thirds of their own way. Tuition covers about two-thirds of the cost of instruction. And I would argue that's a pretty good bargain for Minnesota if someone can turn their life around and get the kind of good job that will enable them to be the kind of contributing member of our society. So I'm here as much as anything to be an advocate of higher education. I've always appreciated that the Higher Education Committee and the people on it tend to be advocates for higher education, recognize the value of it. I applaud you. I hope you'll continue to speak up. And I appreciate what you're doing. I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Winia, I apologize. I had to step out here for a little bit to check into another committee hearing. So I'm going to ask you this question rather than Mr. McCormick, but hopefully he'll get this information to me as well. I'm going to ask the same question that I asked to the U of M, and perhaps you don't have an answer today, but if you can get this information to me, I think it would be helpful just to know, for North Hennepin in particular, how much of the spending reductions that you've had to make, how much of that has been on the instructional side, and how much has that been on the administrative side? What percentage of a cut from their budget have you seen? And then also, University of Minnesota, they put together this handout, and they included some long-term issues on here. I'm just curious, for your institution, your campus in particular, how many staff have you had to reduce? What about, you know, salaries, compensation, things like that? What has it been? If I can, just so I can compare apples to apples.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative Anderson. As I indicated, we actually have not reduced our expenditures for faculty because we have continued to hire faculty to meet student need, and we seek to be very efficient in our scheduling. It means that we're not able to offer low enrollment classes, but where the marginal cost of that additional tuition that those students are bringing in can cover the cost of the salary of a faculty member, we're then able to actually add faculty. We have maintained our staff and administrative at a flat level for the last several years. And so our savings come in a variety of ways. But I need to just acknowledge that a fundamental difference perhaps from us in the university is we've seen enormous enrollment growth because we don't have a cap right now on additional students. And so what we're simply doing is using the tuition revenues to become more productive and efficient, and the kind of reductions that we have been making are, you know, our employees are all state employees. They're not receiving any pay increases for the 2 years here of this contract.
period. I have some concerns about, though, whether or not that is going to be able to continue into the future, and whether or not it's really fair to ask employees to continue to simply take no pay increases. We have sought, where possible, we do actually some shared services with other colleges, and we are seeking to find additional opportunities for that. But we have reduced our budget for more discretionary things like travel and even professional development opportunities. The other area in which we have we are in the process of, as we look ahead, that we're realizing that we may be facing a decision, is we have a campus, an older campus, that has had a significant deferred maintenance problem, and we have devoted, in addition to the HEPA money that this legislature has generously given us, we've also spent some of our internal monies to address some of those needed building repairs, and that's an area that we might be looking at having to reduce substantially in the future.
Representative Pocky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And President Winnie, I have just a couple of questions. One is, I appreciate the second chance idea of the community college. I believe that as well, that it's a second, third chance, whatever it takes is very helpful to make sure that people can get that success and be able to add to our economy and have a personal pride of being successful. I do have some questions about developmental coursework and mm-hmm. trying to get students ready for college.
Yes.
And what percentage of your college do you see, if you have that, put you on the spot a little bit, of what cost that is for your college for the developmental courses or for those students, and how much that takes up of your coursework?
Yeah. Representative Poppy, thank you for your question, and my apologies. We're going to have to get back to you with those precise numbers, but developmental education does constitute a significant portion of our education. Mm-hmm. I hate to take this leap, but I'm going to guess roughly maybe 10%. Okay. But I'll get you a precise number there.
Representative.
Pardon?
President Winnie. I was going to call you Representative Winnie. If I can interrupt you on that point, having been around for quite a while in this system, has that number grown significantly?
I
remember when we tried to get into, whether it was, Minsky Community College where I went or the University of Minnesota, we had to have a certain grade standard. And
right.
And I'm glad that we opened it up, because there are a lot of bright kids that don't do well in high school. But is the actual remedial, if we want to call it that, programming mm-hmm. gone up during your tenure in this whole system?
Well, Representative Roccovina, what I would share with you is, I think in the earlier days of the system, we frankly, and I unfortunately go back 40 years, we didn't have a very robust system of developmental education. And that is something that has actually grown over time. And as we put in place those kinds of requirements for a certain level of proficiency in math, writing, et cetera, it may actually increase the need for certain students to take developmental class. We struggle with this at the campus because we know students don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. They don't want to spend the money for the developmental classes. They want to go straight into those ones that are for college credit. But based upon our own analysis of, so how do students do, we've concluded it's not necessarily the best use of either their money or the state's money to immediately put them into a class where their chances of success are very, very small. What we've done, though, is we've established partnership with the adult basic ed in our area, and they actually have an office on our campus where we encourage students who test at the very low levels of readiness to maximize the amount of services that they can get free of charge from adult basic education, so as to reduce, to the extent possible, the demand then on our developmental ed classes.
So they don't, you're not taking their grant program or their Pell grants and that and using it for those services?
If we can get them into adult basic education, Mr. Chairman, then they don't need to use a Pell grant for that.
Jim Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another question that's not related to that particular. I don't know if Representative Carlson had a follow-up to that. What I just asked, or? Otherwise, I have another question.
I did for clarification, if I may. When you're using the term developmental, does that include ELL, English language learners?
Yes, English language learners would also
be
part of
it. So I assume, being somewhat familiar with your service area, that a big part of whatever increase you may have had over the years would be ELL learners.
Representative Carlson, that is correct. We have a very significant program for English language learners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my other question is just about the college campus reserves. And I know that I believe you said something about you're trying to do a 7-to-1 ratio. And I'm just wondering what the value of doing that in these really dark times to maintain such a vibrant level of reserve. If we would allow the opportunity to be able to spend on reserves to a lower level, and how that would impact and perhaps bridge you through the next few years. And just I'd appreciate some comments about that. I guess I'd just like us to be, we're going to have to be looking at change in every seat cushion and when we're looking at reserves at colleges, and that's my question.
Representative Poppy, I appreciate you asking that question about the reserves. Yes, we have sought to maintain a 7% reserve. And I think one of the things that really clarified to me just how important that was this last 2 years, as we began our discussions and preparations for what could possibly be an H1N1 flu epidemic, and I realized that those 7% reserves would not even cover 2 months of operation. And my nightmare scenario was that we would get a substantial H1N1 outbreak in, say, November, that would build up, and that we would then be in a situation that come January, February, students weren't going to sign up for classes. But we have faculty who still need to be paid. They're on an annual contract. We have legal obligations that have to be covered. And that 7% wasn't going to cover that kind of disaster. But in my mind, that is the kind of issue that is not far-fetched. And I think campuses need to be ready to meet those kinds of challenges without just telling their employees, sorry, we don't have any money.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Winnie, you were talking about increased enrollment, and specifically, I guess, to your college campus. At the same time, what kind of a success rate are we having with students completing the coursework and finishing and getting a job? Any statistics on that at all?
Representative Nornes, Mr. Chairman, the data that we have on that is referred to as the IPEDS data, and it is collected nationally, and it allows us all to compare how we're doing. Now, one of the challenges that two-year colleges face is that in that comparison, we can certainly compare ourselves with other two-year colleges, but the criteria for doing that calculation is to look at what is the success rate, that is the graduation transfer rate for two-year colleges, of first-time students who begin as full-time students. And that leaves out most of the students that we serve. It leaves out, for example, the young man I showed you the picture of, Taj Melson. He's not a first-time student, so we don't get to count him in our data. It leaves out that person whose employer has said, you really need to sharpen up your accounting skills if you're going to have any hopes for advancement in this company. and they come to us and they just complete a 9-credit accounting certificate, it doesn't count them. It doesn't count, and we have a number of these, people who already have a bachelor's degree but have decided they want to become a registered nurse, it doesn't count them. And so that's kind of the precursor to telling you that if you look at the numbers from my college, I can't tell you that these are something that I want to put on a billboard and go out and talk about. And I wish we had a better way of measuring the success of the kinds of students that are served at community colleges.
Thanks. Representative Downey, I'm sorry I missed you.
Oh, that's right.
I got it off track here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and President Wynne. I'm just looking at the North Hennepin Community College page in the legislative report document that's included in our materials, and maybe you could clarify some of this or help me out on this to just understand the exact circumstances at your college. But if I'm reading this right, if I look in the state appropriation and tuition revenue section towards the bottom, underneath those pie graphs there, it looks to me like the state appropriation from 07 to 08 went up $1.4 million. That's about an 11% increase. And then from 08 to 09, it went up $1.2 million. That's about an 8% increase. And if you look at the tuition revenue line going into 08, it went up $1.9 million, which is about a 6% increase, and then from 08 to 09 it went up another $1.6 million, which is about a 6% increase. So those seem to me like fairly healthy increases. Your enrollment in that same period only went up 2.9% in 08 and then 7.2% in 2009. You've been able to hold your tuition increases to relatively reasonable numbers of 4% and 3%. So I'm struggling a little bit to understand how dire things are at your particular college when it seems to me that, you know, obviously we're hitting some rough road in here in this biennium, but historically it feels like you've been in pretty good shape and you've got 0% increases projected for enrollment and very reasonable projected increases in tuition. So, I mean, I'm looking at this just from the surface and saying, boy, it really didn't sound or seem quite as dire as is described. Help me understand where these numbers may be wrong or the picture is different than what the numbers might present.
Representative Downey and Chairman Roccavina, thank you for giving me a chance to make real clear. What I want to do is thank you for the support that you have given higher education. I am not here because I'm complaining about where we are. We have had to use our resources efficiently, and we're quite content to do that. My great concern is when I look ahead to 2012 and the loss of the federal stimulus dollars and the fact of the size of the structural deficit that the state of Minnesota is facing, that's when I think there are horrendous challenges for higher education. So the kinds of increases reflect both our enrollment growth. It also reflects the fact that our share of the state appropriation has increased as our enrollment has increased. And we've tried to use those funds effectively. And so I'm not here to say, woe is me, because what has happened in the past. I'm more concerned about the future.
And Representative Downey, I might just point out, too, that, you know, in 2007, we appropriated the 8 and 9 year you're looking at here. You're not seeing what's happening because of the cuts that we made, and I don't know how they particularly affected North Hennepin, but the $30 million that we, you know, cut when we left here with a package last year, that we were only saved because of the federal stimulus dollars, and then the $30 million that got or that got negotiated out in conference committee, and then the $50 million that got unallotted, and the approximately 10 or whatever it was that we've taken from the Minsky system now. So if you look at those figures out there in 10 and 11, I'm sure that that state appropriation number is going to be trending downward. President Winia.
Mr. Chairman, I actually can share you those numbers. I have them here. They're not represented, you know, in the materials you got. But our general fund appropriation in 2010 was $12,463,000.
So they're less than 2006, Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you.
Right.
And what happens in 11?
Well,
do you go below 2002?
No, actually, because we've experienced a strong enrollment growth, and the system allocation model recognizes that, our appropriation goes down only about half a million, 2011, from what it was in 2010.
Yes. But meanwhile, the whole time, your enrollment has gone way up. You're getting less state dollars, and granted, you're getting some tuition dollars along with it, but keeping up with staff and all the other strains on the system, I'm sure, has been extremely difficult for you. Your hair was a little darker when you served in the legislature, and I think mine might have been, too. And the stress, I'm sure, has a lot to do with the fact that there's a lot of people that maybe are retiring that might not have wanted to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually had my chief financial officer to go back and do a calculation. So how much money did we receive for each FYE? And I'm retiring at the end of 13 years, so I didn't want to go back much further than that. And so what I can share with you that in fiscal 2010, we're receiving the least amount of money per FYE in the 13 years that I've served as president. Now, I also will share with you, though, that tuition has gone up. So our students are carrying a lot of that burden. And I think that's also important for this, you know, committee to recognize that that without those significant tuition increases, I would probably be saying, woe is me. But that has some negative impacts on the kind of student debt load and access for some students to attend college. So I don't want to minimize that.
President Winnie, can we get that chart from you, for at least for me and anyone else?
I will give you a
copy. We can get it to anybody else that's interested. Okay. Any other questions for Representative Gunther?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. President Winnie, I'm glad you're thinking about the next biennium and the deficit we're going to have there, which is a mega deficit compared to the ones we're going through this year. And I think your analogy between that and H1N1 is probably pretty appropriate. But one question that came up in my mind is the reason someone goes to college and spends their money, goes into debt, is to get a diploma so they can say, look what I have. I know I went to your school and got one. And just out of curiosity, what percentage of the students that start going to North Hennepin get a degree?
Get a degree within 3 years?
I don't think I want to make 3 years. I think we have people that go a lot longer than that to your college.
President Winia.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gunther, particularly if we're going to go a lot longer, I'd like to get the precise number and give that to you. That's very important. And But I could share with you that it's not a number as large as we'd like. So I'm really glad you completed.
Well, we're questioning whether you gave him a degree or not. But
I graduated but when Jesse did, but I got a diploma and he didn't.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. President Winnie, I've got, first a comment, of course, when you were talking about, you know, you're not here to complain now, you're here to forewarn. You know, we all have come to pejoratively know that as the cliff that higher ed in Minnesota is driving off, and that's the challenge that this committee and the legislature faces. So I thank you for coming here and sharing your comments. My question for you is, we talked a little bit about second and third chance students. What I see, I certainly see those. I teach up at Lake Superior College. My president, Dr. Nelson, is in the office, who's also retiring this year. I also see a lot of pre-chance, advanced chance, the post-secondary open enrollment students who use our community colleges as an advanced entry into that next level of their education, and it permits them to get out there and get going without having to leave home to do it. You were talking about counting students. How do we account for those students? I mean, how do we account for the boost that we give them onto bigger and better educational aspirations?
President Winnie.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Reiner, I need a little clarification. Are you asking about, are they counted as part of those IPED numbers?
I'm not clear if they are. And if they're not, how do you as a president account for the portion? And I'm not sure at your institution how many of those make up. But it's Dr. Nelson can nod or shake her head. I mean, it anecdotally is a you know, a sizable number of students at some institutions.
What is the PSEO? Do you know a percentage at your school?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bryant, the PSEO percent at my school would be close to about 9%. And if they are full-time, taking 12 credits, they could count as part of that IPETS number. But many of the PSEO students are not 12 credits. Mm-hmm. They may come take 6, 9 credits, but then they take some back in their high school. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't be counted as part of that.
Oh, Mr. Right. Chairman. So I guess my point of what I'm driving at is whether it's the PSEO students or whether it's the second or third chance folks. I mean, in that, you've got, in what community colleges give the state of Minnesota is flex in our higher education system. You know, most of the students that I've had in my classrooms that are post-secondary open enrollment are not going to get a degree from Lake Superior College. They're going to take some number of credits that fit with their high school plans, that fit with their future college plans, and use that as a boost, as a springboard into that next level of education. You know, so it's hard for me to think of a measure we're going to have that's going to account for the benefit to those students, but and also the benefit to us as a state for investing in them in that transitional stage. And I think the same can be said for the other students that we've talked about. You know, that traditional, I'm going to come, I'm going to go full-time, I'm going to start at 18, I'm going to be done at 20. That was me. I did a 2-year program at Wilmer, now Riverland Technical and Community College. You know, I did it in 2 years. I went on, got my undergrad in 4. But, you know, members, and I think we all know this, that's the exception in our community colleges, and that's not the benefit that our community colleges give us here in Minnesota. The benefit they give us is that flex, that ability to be a lot of things to a lot of different people, and all of them, I think, come back to being a front door to higher education in Minnesota. So,
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Reinhardt, I appreciate your comments on that. I was kind of curious, based upon what you've said and also what Representative Norna said, of the students that go through and that are counted, I don't think I heard a number from you, President Winia, on how many actually complete a degree. I would be curious in knowing, you know, for your campus in particular, and of course, Mr. McCormick, for all the campuses within the MinsQ system, how many actually complete a degree, and how many of those, if we have statistics that show how many of those that accessed financial aid through the state of Minnesota. I think that would be helpful for me to know, big picture-wise, too.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, I actually know that the new IPEDS data is just coming out, and I will make sure that you get a copy of that for North Hennepin, and I know the Chancellor will provide it for the rest of the institutions. The financial aid question, I'm not sure we have a database that can tell us that. Let us look into that some more. I don't want to overpromise.
Okay. No. Mr. Chair, I just think that in particular would be helpful for us to know. You know, we have a lot of folks out there that really want to have an education, and our resources in this trying time are very tight with the state grant in particular, and I want to make sure that the student that wants to go to school and complete a degree gets that opportunity to do so. So,
thank you.
We all want that. And, you know, the the opposite side of not educating kids is a lot worse and costs a lot more in the long run. I keep wanting to call you Majority Leader, Madam Majority Leader. And I hate to have you answer all the questions for the Minsky system, but I do want to ask you because, like I said, you're gone now, so you can say whatever the hell you want. But I've noticed in going through these charts, and I'll pick Representative Reiner, your college, Lake Superior College, which basically, using the pie chart from 03 to 09, has pretty much held steady in that 05 to 09 period of FTEs. And even yours, President Winia, from 05 to 10 here on your chart, you've got about maybe 700 more students. And the trend I saw when I went through this whole system is the fact that in many instances, with that little bit of growth or at least holding their own in student numbers, we've seen Minnesota State College faculty numbers go down, and whether you look at Lake Superior or even your chart, and the MAPE numbers increase in a lot of cases significantly. In Lake Superior, it's almost a doubling. What's going on? Is it technology? Is it financial aid? What in the heck is going on that, you know, it looks like the MAPE numbers are really jumping up and the instructors, and it's in both the four-year and two-year systems, it's not the exception but the rule. What's happening?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for the record, I want to correct the materials that you have is all projections for 2010. And so our actual enrollment in 2010 is not 5,030. It's actually closer to 5,800.
Which makes my point even more astounding because... Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the growth, what we see is that our total FTE between 2003 and 2009 in faculty FTE grew by about 100. But we had 295 total employees in 2003, and now we have closer to 400 employees. But the ratios or the proportions have been relatively steady. But as you know, we have had a declining percent for faculty, for ASME, and also for the two administrative groups. The only group that has increased is the MAPE, the Association of Professional Employees. And you have identified a major reason why we've seen an increase in that group. One has been the growth in technology services, particularly as technology is more incorporated into the classroom, the delivery system, the need for that particular skill level has grown. The other thing that would be...
Go ahead, excuse me.
The other thing that would be the case is we have hired additional advisors to do outreach, financial aid, to work particularly, this is the greatest area of growth for our advisors, our student success programs. We have actually hired two advisors who go out and work in the high schools and the middle schools because we have concluded the best way to not spend money on developmental ed is to get to the young people really early and get them engaged in the kind of preparation for college so that they can come ready for college-level work.
But can you do that if you're not involved in the K-12 system? And then is that you can't have student success at all if you don't have somebody in the classroom. And relating to the technology part of it with the online classes as we're going, do the MAPE people teach the online class? Or does the instructor teach the online class?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, we have two MAPE people who support the faculty who teach online classes. And I believe it's fair to say that our faculty are enormously appreciative of these people because our faculty, they are content discipline experts. But sometimes when it comes to translating something into an online presentation, they need assistance. And so we want them to spend their time doing the things that they are trained and ready to do and make it as easy for them so that they don't have to become technology experts to deliver their expertise online.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I'm tempted to say Representative Winnie as well, and something that she didn't point out about her background was that one time she served on this committee. So I think it was for 2 years that you were on the Education Division of Appropriations, as we called it in those days. But I wanted to go back to Representative Anderson's request for information about how many students earn a degree. And this is especially relevant to two-year institutions, I think, but maybe this is a question that the Chancellor can address. But I think we have to keep in mind that many students who attend our two-year institutions end up ultimately transferring. So you've got a transfer issue in terms of how you calculate that. In some programs, and this would probably be more the case with some of our technical colleges, is that you have licensure questions. Some students enroll with the idea of getting a license, for example, heating and air would be one program I know that some of the technical colleges offer, but where there's a license requirement, the student enrolls with that as a goal and not necessarily a degree. And then you have certificates and diplomas as well. So I think the better question, and I don't know if you even can monitor that, is did the student complete his or her educational goals? And it goes back to some of the stats that you were sharing with us, President Winnie, about the kinds of students that you receive on your campus and then how they're calculated as to how whether they've completed a degree or not. Those that initially enroll for the first time, I think, was what you said the calculation mm-hmm. is based on. But I've asked these kind of questions before when we're dealing with completion, and my main point is that it's a lot more complex than just asking how many receive a degree, because a degree is often interpreted in the case of you folks, an associate degree, associate of science, or associate of arts, and there may have been other goals or objectives that the students had. I don't know if you need to comment on that, but.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, your point is very well taken, and frankly, we'd love a better measure of success, but absent a uniform student number that can track a student through every single institution of higher education that they attend, I really not sure how we can accomplish that. And I think the question about success is critically important, but as you point out, it embodies many different things for different people.
Okay, no further questions. President Winnie, thank you.
Thank you
so much for coming today and for all your years of service to both the NIMSCU and the political system.
Thank you. Thank you for your service.
Can I tell them how you can hunt? Mr. Potter, come on up. President Potter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Well, the first thing I want to say, Mr. Chairman, is that when Representative Hawes suggested that I might have the opportunity to speak, he didn't tell me I was going to be following President Winia. tough act to follow. I would echo many of the things that President Winia said, including, first of all, my thanks for your service and for the support of the legislature and the people of Minnesota for our institutions. I tell all our graduates that they have been given a great gift by the people of Minnesota, and we expect them to give back as members of their communities, as taxpayers, and as hopefully donors to our institution. Just to underscore the way in which we are a system, some of you won't be surprised to know that Taj Melson, now Dr. Melson, we were the institution he attended to play hockey. In fact, Dr. Melson was with us in the Mariucci Stadium last fall when we watched our team beat the Gophers on the ice. And we are as proud of his success as President Winia is. I've been asked to speak to particularly to 2000. 12-13 and the strategy, some of the strategies we're using to prepare for that challenge. A couple of weeks ago, I met, I think probably the largest faculty meeting that I've had on our campus since I arrived 3 years ago at the request of the Faculty Senate. They requested that meeting because the week earlier, I had, as our agreement with the IFO requires, informed the Faculty Association that we would be considering retrenchment and tenured faculty layoffs for fiscal year 12. We, in the last 3 years, we have cut about $13 million on a $140 million budget. So in the last, in 9, 10, and 11 together, we've cut about $13 million. We've done that with a total of 6 to 8 layoffs. The bracket is only because we're still coming to closure on a couple for next year. By increasing efficiencies, increasing revenues, and by putting more faculty time into the classroom, our enrollment in that period has grown by almost 1,000 students. But in fiscal year 12, we expect in that 1 year to, and then carried through to the next year, to have to cut about $14 million, $14 to $15 million. We have squeezed all the blood out of the stone that we think we can, and so I don't see that we can negotiate the next biennium without faculty layoffs. If you ask each president of a four-year institution how they've approached these challenges, they'll all be slightly different. We have elected, for a number of reasons, to climb the mountain a little more slowly than some other campuses have. We had a great deal of work to do to build our competence and our understanding of where our costs were, and to build faculty readiness for making some tough decisions. The best news from that meeting with the Faculty Senate a couple weeks ago is that following the meeting, there were no motions made by any members of the Senate. There was no explosion of emails, no letters to the editor, no calls, because the faculty collectively understood that the situation we face is not one of our making. It's not one because they managed their programs badly or the university is not well run. They accept the problem is real, but I think most importantly, they have confidence that we're going to approach the decisions we have to make in an open-handed and fair manner. We have, over the last 2 years, built that expectation, regardless of what the experience of the past may have been, because we've laid a foundation of working with the faculty. We've used the meet and confer processes across our bargaining units extensively. We've had many listening sessions across the campus and with the community. We have met with Representative Hawes and other members of our regional legislative delegation to tell them what was coming and how we were doing this work. We've been open-handed in sharing budget information. If the faculty asked for information, we gave it to them. We have strategic planning committees and budget advisory committees and engagement with students, so that as we prepared the foundations for some tough decisions, we did it as a community. In the start of this current year, we undertook a process to create a data set for all of our academic programs, some 275 programs. We first of all looked at the bottom line, at revenues and expenses for those programs, enrollments, historical trend, market needs, but also alignment with our strategic purposes. We are a public comprehensive university. That means regardless of the changes we make, that we're going to be doing a lot of different things. We are not a a focused academic institution like an art institute. We have a very broad mission. And we conceive of our mission as to prepare our graduates for work and life in the 21st century. And in order to do that, we know that we need to align our academic programs, our research, and our service work with the economy and the character of Minnesota's communities. So we work very closely with business to identify new program needs and opportunities and to evaluate the preparation of our graduates and to tune those programs to the needs of business. We have been doing that work now for 3 years, and with that strategic framework in place and an approach to arraying the data that we developed with the faculty in partnership, hence its credibility, we split our programs into a top and bottom halves. Top half being those that were financially successful against certain benchmarks, bottom half being those obviously that were less successful. We then asked for detailed reports from the departments that ran those programs in the bottom half, which resulted in February in a proposed set of recommendations for elimination. We then spent 2 months working with the community to give opportunity for people to respond, talking to students. I personally saw to every email that came into the president's office from an alum or a student about programs that were threatened. In the end, after student input, faculty senate input, and the provost review of the dean's input after faculty conversations, I determined that we would eliminate 26 academic programs, a tenth or so of the programs we have on the list. There was upset and sadness, but there was no rebellion, no allegations, again, no letters to the press alleging some backroom deals or other evidence that we weren't keeping faith with our promises. That process only resulted in eliminating 9 faculty positions, which we will now do. It affected, there are 135 students enrolled in those programs. And so we've eliminated the lower end, the weakness. But the most important part of that process was that we built credibility with our partners, with our faculty and staff across the campus for the tougher work that we have to do ahead. As one of my colleagues has said, I've cut the programs that are losing money. I've cut the programs that are a misfit for who we are. The next cuts we have to make will be things that are successful, but not as successful as the programs at the top of the list. We have now asked our campus community to rank order all the programs in the top half, and we will enter a process over the summer in preparation for early fall conversations with the faculty that will drive us to a reorganization which will save administrative positions and the program next step in program redefinition, which will result in some lost faculty positions. We'll follow our agreement, eliminating temporary positions first. And one of the reasons we put this off is by increasing revenues, achieving efficiencies, building consensus, and focusing strategically. If we just cut positions to hit the target we have to for fiscal year 12, I think we would have to eliminate 80 faculty positions. My best guess, given the multiple strategies we have in place and the time we're taking to do this, it would be closer to 25. Mr. Chair, I welcome your questions.
Questions at all? I guess I have one, President Potter. How has, you know, the early retirement money that we put out there with stimulus money and that, and you obviously had some takers on that. But what happens when we don't have the money to do that? Would it be helpful to try to find some money for the next biennium, or are we getting to the point where we really can't let anybody else go? And that early retirements, as Mr. Fitzenritter said, aren't going to really be you know, jumped on by faculty or AFSCME or whomever.
Chair Riccavina, I've got a couple things to say before I answer that question. We haven't used any of the early retirement opportunity yet. Our situation is that we were engaged in a process of strategic rethinking the university, which we would have done anyway, and were overtaken by the budget challenges. We determined that we would work through the strategic thinking to direct those areas where we had excess capacity in order to best use the opportunities that the legislature has provided through the early retirement incentives. We may or may not use that program in the coming year, but if we do use it, we think that we have about $1 million in our reserve funds that we could use to fund the upfront costs to achieve the savings through 25 or so early retirements. And we'll want to target those offers to the departments with capacity that we identify through the planning we're doing in the next 3 months. We deliberately have not used that money yet because we wanted to be its availability to be driven by the strategic thinking that we are now near completion.
Has anyone in the system, and I know this is probably not a fair question for you, but has anyone in the system talked about with faculty, with other bargaining units, the furlough type approach or that the university had, or just maybe some of our own members have come to me and said maybe we should have mandated just shutting all of our schools down for a couple of 3 days just to show the public what's actually happening?
Well, let me answer one thing that you said first, Mr. Chair. Some of our campuses have used the early retirement incentives already as part of their strategy, and I couldn't, I won't presume to speak for them. I would not be a fan of the furlough strategy because I believe our budget shortfall is structural, and the furlough approach is a useful bridging strategy, but I don't think it addresses the core problem. Our costs are going up. Health care, the tails of contract agreements, energy, and everything else that we pay for. The share of the legislative share, the state share through appropriation of our budget has declined to 42%. Now tuition has gone up. Our tuition has been capped by the legislature. So we don't have the freedom that the university does to increase tuition. It looks very modest. I would refer to Representative Downey's comments earlier. It looks modest at 3% only because we were capped at 5% and asked to use the stimulus money to buy down to 3%. So we have made the cuts that we have made as a consequence of being between the rock and a hard place on the budget. Assuming that you don't make that period of holding tuition to a certain limit up at any point by greatly increasing the charges to students, we now have built into the budget a structural problem that furloughs don't address. Could we use that? Have we talked about it? Our faculty have offered. They've volunteered for next year to do that. It doesn't fix our core budget problem.
Just a point of clarification, we did also put in, I don't know if we put in statute, but we did have an agreement with the university that they would also have a tuition cap. It was a dollar amount that Mr. Fitzenreiter did refer to. And Mr. President, you are right, we have a structural problem not only in the higher education system but in our budget.
Yes, sir.
That we haven't really addressed for the last 7 years. And seriously needs to be addressed because it's not only affecting the higher education system but all different portions of our society, I think. Representative Haas.
Thank you. President Potter, I'd like to compliment you on the actions that you have taken, your school and your faculty and everybody that's been involved. It has been very open and people do understand it, but that doesn't necessarily make it less painful. I was wondering if, in your redesigning process, if there's any relationship between our community college, our tech college in town, and the state college, and if there's any partner in the redesign effort that you could better use your faculty or better use your facilities in order to do it more efficiently or more efficiently and save money.
Chair Recovina, Representative Hawes, we the redefinition of the St. Cloud Technical College's mission to St. Cloud Technical and Community College offers a great many opportunities for closer partnership with them. We already have a close partnership. We provide housing for them, some of their students. We provide security services. We consult regularly. Our students move back and forth between the two institutions now. We have a program in partnership with Anoka Ramsey Community College on our campus. Students who fail to meet our admission standards, and there are some 200 on our campus, can enroll in an Anoka Ramsey Associates program on our campus, live in our dorms, become part of our campus community, and when their performance reaches our standards, transfer into St. Cloud State. With the new mission of the Technical Community College, that partnership will be transferred to a partnership with them, which allows us greater capacity to develop a seamless connection with them and do a more resource sharing with them. So it's a tremendous opportunity.
Mr. Chair, thank you. President Potter.
You know, I noticed when I was reading through the report that there were quite a few in the different individual colleges and universities, a reference to this lean approach, which, you know, I had heard, including actually yours, too. So, you know, I figured I didn't actually, you know, knew it was used in, you know, places like Toyota and that, which is really a good example of how they're doing recently. So I went online to see what these consultants were saying about lean, and I just want to give you folks a clear picture of what their statement of lean was on the lean website, and it's to accomplish this, lean thinking changes the focus of management from optimizing separate technologies, assets, and vertical departments to optimizing the flow of products and services through the entire value streams that flow horizontally across technologies, assets, and departments to customers. So I guess, is that pretty clear to everybody? Because I had no idea what now they were talking about. So you must have to have a doctorate degree to understand what lean...
geometry.
Yes. Representative Briner, I hope that's not what Minsky was, you know, their approach to this whole...
Mr. Chair, if I
go
could...
Go ahead, Mr. Potter. Maybe you can explain it to this poor Iron Ranger, what that meant.
If I can give a couple of examples. To use the lean process, and it's a buzzword, and there are political reasons for using it, but to use that method to improve your effectiveness... You bring together all the people who touch various pieces of work. So if it's an admissions process, there'll be people from academic affairs and student affairs and the admissions office and the registrar's office to look at the paperwork involved and to simplify and pull costs out of the system. We've got a graduate office that is still, for example, doing its admissions processing in paper. And the technology now is available to put much of that online with a great savings in costs. The dean of the graduate office has been is asking me to hire two new people for that office for the last 2 years, and I've said no, because I believe we can pull off enough work out of what they do by simplifying the processes and by streamlining across those various units so that we can accomplish the work and do a better job without having to hire any more people. We have to do that kind of thing in everything that we do in order to best use state dollars to put them into the classroom. The lean process is not something that applies very well to what goes on in the classroom, but for all the administrative work the university does, they're very useful tools. My commitment to doing this work comes from the 4 years I spent at Cornell as Director of Organizational Development there, and my experience as an evaluator for the Malcolm Baldrige Award, which does have an educational version and makes a tremendous difference in the ability of institutions to best use limited state resources.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we may not have time for much of an extensive discussion, but I'm just going to make a few observations. I've been trying to follow your notes in some detail here on St. Cloud, and I represent Mankato, so Minnesota State Mankato is a university that I'm more familiar with the approach we've taken, and we might be one of the institutions you were pointing to as more aggressive in terms of the approach to retrenchment and faculty reduction. But as I look at the approaches, and I know each university will be taking its own unique, you know, it's a community, and its leadership has a style, and its staff has a style, and so forth. But I think we might have something to learn by comparing the paths taken by our different four-year institutions and understanding the gains to be made as we move toward this cliff where we have to make some more dramatic decisions. As we look at, I'm very interested in your cluster approach and your challenge maybe to look at some of the bargaining unit agreements and see what we might do to better, you know, serve our academic disciplines. And I know MSU Mankato has taken an aggressive approach to some administrative reductions. And so you may not have any comment, but I'm assuming that the four-year institution leadership talks across institutional lines to one another about their approaches. So I'd be interested in some of that discussion.
Chair Representative Briner, simple answer is yes. President Davenport and I, as the leaders of the two largest institutions in Minsk U, have very similar challenges. Our numbers are comparable. Our histories are a little different, and the structures and the program portfolios we have to lead are different because of those histories, and that's really instructive when it comes to, well, Dick, why did you do it this way, and why did I do mine this way? So we have been in conversation watching each other's work, and you're quite right. There's a great deal to learn from each other. And among the other four-year institution presidents, we share notes as well. I mean, I know Dick has used the board's early retirement incentive that the legislature approved, for example, and other details about the way he's approached his work.
Okay. Well, no further questions, members, and all of the presidents that came and staff. I appreciate it. I'm, you know, really nervous about what's going to happen to our entire public higher education system if we don't do something to correct our structural deficit. Is there anybody, Ms. King or whomever, that can give us a projection of, you know, if there is no federal money coming in the next biennium, if there is no increase in the base, with the caps being lifted, we're at a 10% jump in tuition, I guess, 5 times 10, no buy-down. What are we talking about in the 12-13 biennium as far as tuition hikes?
Members, if you go to the front of the document, the March 15th document, you'll see a narrative there that describes for you the way we thought about that question and the advice we gave the campus.
I jumped all those nice pie charts. I must have missed that.
I think it's the third written page. You'll see a list there of the assumptions that we asked the campuses to start their planning from for 12 and 13. As you've heard, I think, from all of the speakers today, this is a time of great ambiguity. As we think about planning for 12 and 13, the state's fiscal outlook at this juncture in the process is as bad as I've ever seen it. And as we think about biennial budget planning, it's a question of bad or worse from an outlook standpoint. So we spent a lot of time talking as a leadership council about how should we plan for this, how should we think about this. And what you see in this document today and what's outlined there in the front of the document is the advice we provided, which was to build some models at the campus level that assume about $100 million reduction in state appropriation in 12 and 13 to the system. That's a really substantial number. That's $100 million off about a $1.2 billion base at this point. And let me tell you how we arrived at that, because it's just a complete, planning framework. We arrived at that by recognizing first the current published revenue shortfall, the $5.4 billion, and then saying for planning purposes, the legislature and the next governor could choose to solve that either entirely on the expense side or through some combination of new revenues and expense reductions. If they do the former, if it's a completely an expense side solution, that's a reduction to us in the $200 million plus dollar range in 12 and 13. That would be a spectacularly damaging number. If, on the other hand, the legislature and the governor are dealing with a number like that and choose to solve it with a combination of expense side reductions and revenue increases, call it half, that's how we got to the $100 million. It's a complete, let's just try to think about how we might plan for this. So the schools have all been provided with the number to them that's a consequence of both of those assumptions. And that's given them what we hope is sort of a bracket around the exposure we have to budget reductions in the coming biennium. We have not yet asked the board to articulate a position on tuition for 12 and 13. What they have said to us, and what you see in the narrative there, is their expectation that our approach to tuition will be reasonable, which is to say you're not likely to see us coming forward next year with a tuition increase of 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 15%. That is completely in conflict with the board's commitment to access and to affordability and to maintaining our ability as far as we can to serve students. I think you heard from President Winia that we are really up against it from a capacity standpoint. As revenues constrict, as expenses continue to go up, we are reaching a point at some of our institutions where we are in de facto enrollment caps already. To the extent we use tuition increases to buy back some of that capacity, we're trading off access for affordability. So the board is very, very committed to this core principle of affordability, but they're worried about the access constraints that we're going to face in the next couple of years as the state struggles to maintain its support. So at this point, we have no official position on tuition. What we've worked with the presidents is around this reasonable idea, but we haven't tried to value what reasonable is because we're waiting for the legislature and the revenue forecast to give us a little bit clearer picture of what our future looks like.
I don't know if any of us know that answer. Okay. Any further questions? If not, thank all of you for being here. And we're meeting on Thursday. So
I need to vote for approving the minutes. Could you do that?
Oh, yes. Representative Narnas moves to approve the minutes of the
March 25th
meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. 10 o'clock in room 10?
Yes.
10 o'clock, room 10, meeting adjourned.